I have with me today Luisa Martinez to talk about her personal experience growing up as an undocumented person and how becoming a socialist brought her a sense of dignity as an immigrant from the global south to the global north. Luisa Martinez is a member of Portland DSA and the National Political Committee of DSA. She's been involved with organizing for immigrants' rights for 15 years. Welcome to KBOO and to the Old Mole Variety Hour, Luisa Martinez.
Thank you, Patricia.
You published an article entitled How Socialism Brought Me Dignity as an Undocumented Person. You wrote about how you were born in Chile and were brought by your family to Florida at an early age, and then you grew up in Florida as an undocumented person. I wanted to start by asking you what it was like growing up undocumented.
Well, I'll say it's a complicated story of how my family arrived to the United States. But basically, the only reason why we were able to get a visa is because my grandpa was working in a restaurant. He befriended an embassy worker. And so it was just kind of a favor that we were even able to access a visa, honestly. But like many immigrants, you know, that visa expired and then we stayed. In the article, in terms of what it was like growing up being undocumented, I share a couple of stories. You know, there were lots of times where I was taken advantage of, you know, as a worker. And so I could only work under the table jobs. And so I wasn't able to legally drive, which meant I took 3 buses to work, you know, utilizing a transportation system that's very underfunded and inadequate for the population in South Florida. So just to give you an example, one of my jobs that I had for a while, it took maybe 45 minutes to get there by car, and it took me 2.5 hours. But that's what a lot of people deal with, right? Like, it was just what was available to me at the time. You know, one story I didn't share in the article, a couple stories, was I actually had 2 bosses that just refused to pay me for different reasons. One was Hillary's Deli in West Palm Beach, Florida. I will say this was 20 years ago. So I'm sure they have new management, but that one, I explained, you know, my situation, and I'm undocumented, and he's like, that's fine. And so I only worked there for a couple days, maybe 4 or 5 days. And then I went to just ask for my salary, which I want to make clear, for tip workers in Florida, I think it was like $2.25, maybe an hour. That tip workers got paid. So it's very, very little. And I asked him, like, hey, could I have my pennies, please? And he's like, well, I'm not paying you. You don't pay taxes. And so he just refused to pay me. He's like, you can just work off tips. And so that was one place. Another place, but it was a Jewish deli. And that one, I was pretty lucky. That one was pretty close to where I lived. And so, like I said, tip workers got paid $2.25 or something like that. And I just happened to be working there when the wage went up $1. So whopping $3.25 or something like that, right? And they were paying me the hourly, but then they didn't give me the raise. And I asked the other workers, like, if they had gotten an increase, and they said yes. And so I printed an article showing that the tip wage had increased and that they were stiffing me, honestly. And so I print that out, I gave it to them, and I said that I quit. And so one of the owners called me later that day. She was livid. And again, she's like, well, you don't pay taxes. I was like, well, it doesn't mean that you don't get to pay me. And I would love to pay taxes. And furthermore, it's one kind of tax. Immigrants still pay every other kind of tax you can imagine, right?
So their justification was that because you weren't paying taxes, they didn't have to pay you as much.
An hourly wage, yeah. Which, like I said, was not a lot of money. I just want to say there were other instances too, stuff like sexual harassment, but I barely put it in the article because I feel like every woman worker deals with that. Mm-hmm. You know, the point that I make is that my vulnerability in that moment just meant that I just kind of had to take it. I felt like I had, who was I going to talk to? The police? Like, get out of here.
There were other consequences too that you write about because you were very keen on going on to college. I mean, you talk in the article about what that meant for you.
Yeah. There was other, I mean, the psychological kind of things I talk about is just associating being Latin American with poverty in my situation. And I come from a family that's very uneducated. I was the first one to graduate high school in my family. And so I wasn't really taught for instance, about the long shadow that the U.S. government has cast, not just in Latin America, but for the global South. And so I associate it with shame, being Latin American with shame. And I internalized this kind of guilt, the kind of narratives that you hear about undocumented workers that we're taking from other people, et cetera, which was, again, I didn't make the choice to come to the United States, but even the people who do make that choice, it's for very good reasons. And it's because opportunities are not available in their home country. And so, you know, what I didn't know was why we'd come here. And I didn't know why there was such a large Latin American community in the United States.
You then, still as an undocumented person, tried to enroll in community college. And tell us what happened then.
I tried more than once. And so they basically told me that they weren't accepting anybody on a tourist visa or even expired visa because of the second 9/11, because of the hijackers with the Twin Towers. And so it didn't matter that I graduated from Florida schools. That wasn't enough to be able to enroll me. The only option that was available to me was enrolling as an international student, which is multiple times the tuition rate, which might as well have been $1,000,000,000. Like it wasn't accessible to me as a, you know, given how much money it was to go to school. You know, you don't have access to loans, right? I didn't have access to financial aid until I got my paperwork.
And how old were you when you finally got your papers?
So I was just shy of my 21st birthday.
I recall that that was a process that took some 18 years or something. It was hideously complicated, and there were more opportunities for your family to be exploited and their money taken and get nothing back for it.
Yeah. So my grandfather tried three times to get to kind of start the process. The first time, the person who maybe probably wasn't an attorney just robbed him, didn't do anything for us. They just kind of took his money. Second time, the person died, you can believe, which is just unfortunate for everybody involved, right? And then the third time, we were successful. So that happened under IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, under Reagan, of all people. So that was amnesty. So that's a little bit different in that it didn't matter how you came to the United States. Everybody was afforded an opportunity if you met certain standards to be able to apply for citizenship. But that's extremely rare.
People don't have access to that option now.
No. And actually, most people who cross the border undocumented, not through a port of entry, it's really not available. Adjustment of your legal status really isn't available to you. So for a lot of people, the door's not open. And even when it is, it takes a very, very long time. And so the process was, my grandfather, he applied for his residency, and then you have to wait 5 years and then you can apply for citizenship. But all of this costs money. And for somebody who doesn't speak English, for the type of person that doesn't really understand bureaucracies, it's not educated, that's a lot more intimidating than like an educated middle-class person.
Okay, so you get your papers, and then how did your life change?
Well, I could finally go to school, which was the most important thing, which, you know, I identified as one way, really the only way of being able to get out of the cyclical poverty that my family kind of experienced. You know, I was tired of working all these jobs, and I just didn't want to struggle anymore. So yeah, I went to school. And so I eventually made it to the University of Florida for, was it my bachelor's, and then eventually my master's too.
The kind of the common narrative about why people immigrate is that those countries down there in the global South are poor, and they're poorly run, and they're corrupt, and they're violent. And of course, people want to come and take advantage of all the opportunity that's in America. So it's this blaming kind of narrative. And you're in school, and at some point you encounter the ideas of socialism, and you get an exposure to a different narrative. So talk a little bit about that.
You know, eventually I got involved in immigrants' rights. I went to school. That's how I got involved in activism. I thought at that time, I thought I wanted to be an attorney because I say in the article, I was struggling with liberalism, that I was get caught up in this idea if I could just get access to the system that I could change it, not really understanding how movements work or anything like that. But I read Noam Chomsky's Latin America from Colonization to Globalization. It's a series of exchanges between him and somebody named Heinz Dietrich. He's a journalist. And so I finally learned through that book why there's so many Latin Americans in the United States. And it's because of generations and generations of kind of global North oppression in Latin America, material extortion, counter-revolution. And so it helped me to understand, for one thing, why there are so many Latin Americans here. And it helped me move past this narrative of the so-called American dream. I was very much a dreamer at that point. I guess I got my paperwork, but when I was younger, I was a dreamer. You know, for me, that was such a tired narrative, because that, in my mind, that's charity, right? You're trying to appeal to people's bleeding hearts around a topic when it should be centered around some iota of justice. And so that's what that book helped me understand. And it also helped me understand that, you know, those of us from the global South came to the United States to reclaim our share of the resources that had been taken from our home countries by the global North, by the United States. And so I just stopped feeling ashamed. And really, we're just here to get our share of what the United States took from our countries.
Maybe talk a little bit about Chile, since that's your country of origin, and about the U.S. intervention there. And because I think it's a similar story in many of the Latin American countries.
So in 1973, there was very famously a coup against a democratically elected social democrat president named Salvador Allende. And so after that were many years of dictatorship. There was a U.S. Backed dictatorship, dictator who was installed. Many thousands of people were killed. It's the first 9/11, right? It happened on September 11. And so there's not too many Chileans come to the United States, but I think like other examples are clearly Cuba, you know, the blockade, the U.S. Imposed blockade that's strangling Cuba, that drives a lot of the migration from the island, particularly to South Florida, right? In Guatemala, there was a coup, very famously in 1954. Haiti, two coups. Honduras in 2009, and El Salvador in the 80s. And so I could go on and on. There's lots of examples, not just in Latin America, in the global South, that drives this kind of migration, right? Why these kind of opportunities aren't available in countries like Bolivia.
And what, from your perspective, is behind this repeated American intervention to suppress any kind of liberatory impulse in the global South?
Well, it's capitalism, right? It's resource extraction. There's nothing more terrifying to the United States than sovereignty, that any one of these countries in Latin America and the global South, again, would have sovereignty to use their material resources for the population, right? And so that's what happened in Chile. That's what happened in Cuba. That's what happened in so many of these countries, and why the United States poured money into these counter-revolutions.
In order to basically protect the ability of U.S. corporations to enter into those countries and extract whatever minerals, coffee, bananas. Isn't there an element also of wanting to secure markets for American products?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you go to Panama, there's everybody, the consumption of spam is really disturbing. You see lots of, you know, Coca-Cola in Latin America, you see lots of Nestle. I'll give you a great example. My grandparents wake up every morning and they drink that horrible instant coffee. Yeah, it's Nestle instant coffee. And it's like, you guys, we're Latin American. Like, we have access to the best coffee in the world. Why are you drinking this crap? But it's just because that's the products that they were used to, right? There's so many examples of that. And, you know, the United States benefits twice. Once in the kind of maintenance of these markets. And then the second thing is the economic, benefiting from the economic forces that drive individuals to migrate from the poorest countries to the richest ones. Right. And then you have this workforce that is vulnerable, right? That sometimes you can pay less. And so they benefit twofold that way.
Both from getting cheap labor, moving from the South, and being able to export their goods to markets in the global South, like this horrible instant coffee. Why is it then that people aren't consuming the locally grown coffee?
Well, when you're importing cheap US goods, you don't make very much money to begin with. It's going to drive out local businesses, of course. Also flood the market with US products.
I mean, why is Nestle's crappy instant coffee cheaper than, nice whole beans that, the farmer down the road is selling?
Well, the flood of US goods into Latin America drives out, it just close, it's just like what you have here with the Walmart, right? It forces kind of these mom and pop operations to close down.
Because they just can't compete because of their particular small operations. So part of it is economies of scale, and part of it is, I suspect, some subsidies and the trade agreements.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have, with NAFTA, for instance, you have US growers being taking their excess, what they're unable to sell, right? Corn, whatever, and then flooding rice. We saw that with Haiti, right? Haiti was flooded with rice. And actually, I heard a story recently about USAID that it's affecting US workers because they're no longer that was part of the program that bought that excess with them, that excess produce from them to be able to dump on these other countries.
What about the drug trade? I'm talking about the illicit drug trade. Does that drive immigration in any significant way?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, people get tired of the violence. Well, for one thing, there wouldn't be such a, like people talk about Mexico and fentanyl. Well, these markets wouldn't exist if there wasn't such a huge appetite for them in the United States. That's one thing. But like I had a friend of mine in Colombia that I met when I was able to go to college. And she told me, she's like, it just got so bad. We just couldn't even go out. Like it, we would go to just a bar or whatever. And if there was a narco there, they would just, say like, give me your girlfriend. Illicit drugs have played various roles in Latin America. On the one hand, at times being a source of funding for revolutionary movements, but for the most part, it helps the United States. It gives the United States a reason to send a ton of what is oftentimes characterized as aid to countries like Colombia, but really in the form of paramilitary troops to be able to control the population.
What is DSA doing? How are they organizing or trying to resist those threats of deportation?
Yeah. So one more note about, I think, the fear. I will say it's kind of a fear that never goes away. Like I have my citizenship now, but it's still really intimidating for me to just go into any government institution. Like when I first moved to Washington State, I know I had to switch my license, right? And I just couldn't, just the thought of going into something as pretty harmless as the DMV. It just took me, I was dragging my feet to be able to do it. And I know it was because of that. But, in terms of what the response has been, I will say I've been an immigrants' rights activist for many years, including under Obama. I will be surprised if Trump deports anywhere near the level of people that Obama deported. We called him the deporter in chief. He deported so many damn people. For me, this is just Obama again. I think maybe the difference between somebody like Obama and Trump is really the rhetoric. People feel emboldened to not have to hide their feelings so much, the xenophobia that they might have maybe thought twice about. I remember the first time Trump got elected, I was in South Florida and I was working adjacent to the school system and I heard a lot of stories about bullying, for instance. That was newer. Bullying always exists, right? You just kind of see more of it because people feel emboldened. And they're just repeating the stuff that their parents said, sadly. But anyway, to answer your question in terms of what DSA has been doing, so we've revived our immigrants' rights group. We have been training chapters on how to respond to some of this. So I personally, I could talk about Know Your Rights trainings. I did them in Florida. I've been doing them here in the Pacific Northwest. That I would recommend anybody go to, but if you work with immigrants, encourage them to attend, whether or not they're documented, because a lot of immigrants are a part of mixed status families. For instance, myself, my mom, we were undocumented, but my two cousins were born here. They were citizens, right? I had a aunt, she had her green card. My grandpa got a citizenship, so it was just mixed status. Know Your Rights clinics, I think, are the biggest. It's the most powerful thing that you can do, honestly. to protect undocumented communities, because particularly in the Pacific Northwest, it's actually not that easy to deport people. If they know to invoke their right to remain silent, you don't give a reasonable doubt to an ICE agent by continuing to talk to them, right, to answer their questions, you don't have to answer their questions. And so that's the first thing that you learn in a Know Your Rights training. So empowering people to just remain silent and understanding that ICE needs a judicial warrant in order to enter the home, and it can't just be an administrative order. You know, those things like that will actually, I believe, go a long way to preventing deportations. And so locally, there's a Deportation Defense Coalition. There's lots of ways that people have responded. And so in Oregon, particularly, there's a lot of NGOs that have been doing really great work. And then also we're doing it locally with DSA too. We just...
So what I hear you saying is that all the rhetoric that we've been hearing about how ICE is going to come into our churches, our homes, our schools, our hospitals, and just snatch people up, that is really more rhetoric than reality, that ICE, for a variety of reasons, logistical, legal, lack of local cooperation from law enforcement, perhaps in some jurisdictions, it's just not as easy to do as what the rhetoric maybe makes it sound like, and that what is behind all that rhetoric is trying to appease a right-wing nationalist base.
So the schools and churches thing. So under Obama, he issued a memo about safe spaces, safe locations, and so it said ICE should not go into schools and churches, stuff like that. Still did anyway, I can tell you. It was just more in rural areas where there wasn't quite as much community accountability. There weren't many as people watching, so it still happened under Obama. Trump revoked that. That it was just a memo. It's not a law or anything like that. And so he said, no, we have every right to go into schools and churches. And so that has happened. ICE getting onto school buses, ICE showing up in colleges and universities, that is happening. But again, going back to like what you need to be able to deport somebody, the ICE agent needs to have reasonable suspicion, reasonable suspicion. And so if you don't engage with them, they won't have it. But I will say it gets a little bit messier in states where you do have cooperation of ICE with the police. And so in Washington and Oregon, it's very much the case that it is against the law for the police to be able to cooperate with ICE. And so that's huge. That's enormous in terms of preventing deportations.
So it varies quite a bit from place to place in terms of how freely ICE is going to be able to operate and how effective they're going to be.
Exactly. And it also depends on, again, going back to whether or not that person knows their rights at the end of the day.
Right. Before we close, do you want to say anything further about what DSA is pursuing as a strategy to assist immigrant communities?
Well, you know, we can always use more help. There's the Portland DSA chapter. We have branches in Washington County and Vancouver. And so if anybody's interested, I encourage you to join. And the more people can get involved, the better.
Thank you, Louisa, very much for joining me today and talking about your personal story.
Thank you.